This is text for audiobook of The Magical Battle of Britain, by Dion Fortune. Text can be followed by downloading the open PDF book online. Introduction, by Gareth Knight. Dion Fortune was a remarkable woman in many ways, a pioneering type of whom it may be said not only that she lived before her time but that she did much to shape the times that came after her. Born in Llandudno, in North Wales, in 1890, by her early twenties, despite no great formal education, she had become a leading psychotherapist. This was in a pre-First World War London, when horse-drawn buses still plied the streets, and when the psychoanalytic discoveries of Sigmund Freud were beginning to take the world by storm. With his theories of the subconscious, and the importance of dreams, and the role of the suppressed sexual libido of everyday life, a whole new approach to the human mind was being born. But revolutionary as these psychological theories were, Dion Fortune felt they did not go far enough to explain some of the hidden powers and secrets of the mind. She had stumbled almost by accident upon the powers of telepathy, which she found to be demonstrable within herself. This came about in a wholly unexpected and coincidental way. She used to attend a local Theosophical Society meeting house for the simple if lowly reason that it was near her clinic and had good catering facilities. It was thus a convenient place to lunch. One day, almost in a spirit of jest, she stayed on for one of the lecture demonstrations, and discovered to her amazement that she was picking up the images that the lecturer was projecting in a simple experiment in telepathy. This first-hand evidence could not be ignored, nor could it be explained by any of the current theories of psychology. So she made a point of looking out for unusual conditions of the mind that even the new psychoanalysis could not account for. In this she was helped by a co-worker at one of the clinics. This was a Dr. Theodore Moriarty, who had long experience in India, where there is more knowledge and less skepticism about the hidden powers of the mind. The bonds of convention were, in the meantime, tightening. The British Medical Association ruled that only qualified medical practitioners should be recognized as analysts. This squeezed Dion Fortune out of her practice, but the war came along anyway, and in common with thousands of other women of the time, she aided the national war effort by working on the land, to help make the country self-sufficient for food in a time of blockade. At a later stage of the war, she helped conduct research into the use of soy as an alternative to meat. She continued working with Moriarty, and what she learned and experienced from their association she wrote up in fictional form as The Secrets of Dr. Taverner. Dr. Taverner is loosely based on Moriarty and an approach to psychic or psychological disturbances that goes beyond the current theory and practice of psychological and medical science. This included the use of hypnosis, reading the state of the aura, reference to past incarnations, very fringe methods indeed medically speaking, to cope with various obsessions, suicidal tendencies, or apparent split personalities. Dion Fortune claimed that although some of the stories might seem unbelievable, or to have been written up for dramatic effect, she had in fact felt it necessary to tone down some of the factual circumstances to make them fit for general publication. However, as her knowledge of the deeper side of the mind progressed, so she moved away from abuse and pathology toward the more positive realm of personal fulfillment, self-improvement and spiritual enlightenment. To this end, like the analytical psychologist C.G. Jung, she studied spiritual traditions from many parts of the world, including the myths and legends of the ancient world, and discarded and outmoded sciences such as magic and alchemy. She also studied under different contemporary teachers, seeking anywhere that might give her knowledge of the powers of the human mind. This included membership of a famous occult society, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, that attracted many notable personalities of the time, particularly from the world of the arts. These included the poet W.B. Yeats, the novelists Brodie Innes and Charles Williams, the children's writer Edith Nesbit, and a director of the Tate Gallery, Sir Gerald Kelly. She studied directly under Moyeena MacGregor Mathers, the wife of its principal founder, and a daughter of the philosopher Henri Bergson. But as she progressed further in her quest, so she found that powers were awakening within her own mind. She seemed to be recovering what appeared to be memories of past lives, with their ancient wisdom. In their process, she taught herself the techniques of trance mediumship, for she was no believer in relying upon the psychic powers of others. All this led to her deciding to form her own group and teaching center. Initially called the Community of the Inner Light, it later expanded into a fraternity and then into a society, and has proved to be a source of inspiration and guidance to sincere seekers ever since. An impressive roll of occult writers and teachers have since passed through its portals. The community's first base was at Glastonbury, towards which Dion Fortune was always strongly attracted. By one of those strange synchronicities that occur when someone is about to find their true life's work or destiny, she was offered a plot of land at the foot of Glastonbury Tor, on the actual Holy Hill itself, and a government surplus army hut to put on it. Soon she was established on the Tor, on the holiest earth in England, and a group of small chalets was built within the enclosed garden to accommodate students and kindred spirits. Three strands of interest attracted her to Glastonbury, and they remain the core of her teaching and life's work. One was the Arthurian legend of the Knights of the Round Table, which includes the quest of the Holy Grail. Second was the mystical ambience of the place, as the site of the first Christian church in England. And third was the elemental significance of the earth itself, for Glastonbury is a site of ancient powers that go back far beyond recorded history, as the remains of a spiral trackway up the Tor to the Standing Tower suggest. Glastonbury is full of associations of King Arthur. Some associate it with Camelot, the king's great palace. Others, more mystically, see it as the Isle of Avalon, from which the once and future king will one day return to save his country and people. In the Middle Ages, the tomb of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere, complete with lock of yellow hair, were found before the high altar of the abbey, on a plot still marked in the green sward. The full range of Arthurian annals was drawn upon by Marion Zimmer Bradley in her epic novel The Mists of Avalon, drawing upon traditions also expounded by Dion Fortune, concerning Merlin, Morgan le Fay, the Lady of the Lake, and other characters of ancient legend. Also John Cooper Powers' monumental novel, A Glastonbury Romance. On the mystical side, Dion Fortune loved the abbey, once the finest in England, but now no more than a ruin, desecrated by King Henry VIII, who also martyred its abbot. It still retains a grand magnificence from those of its walls still standing. Not only is it a place of profound peace and harmony, but the veil is thin, not only to the spiritual world but to the psychic as well. It was here that a contemporary of Dion Fortune, a qualified archaeologist, Dr. Blake Bond, discovered hitherto unknown parts of the structure, buried beneath the ground. He made these discoveries through being guided by the automatic writing of a psychic friend, apparently from medieval monks who had lived and worshipped there. What they revealed turned out to be true, and a new chapel was found when diggings were made. The church authorities, however, could not come to terms with this psychic means of archaeological investigation, and despite his record of success, Dr. Bligbond's services were terminated. Dion Fortune linked the Christian mystical tradition and the Arthurian at her London headquarters, which she set up a few years later as her society grew in numbers. She established public services wherein the Holy Grail was a major part of the ceremony. It was visualized as a cup of inspiration hovering over the heads of the celebrants, thus linking a powerful form of mind working, concerted meditation upon evocative and sacred images, with conventional forms of worship. The third aspect of Dion Fortune's work had to do with the elemental powers of nature, that can be channeled through ancient sacred centers and the ley lines that run between them. Glastonbury is associated with such traditions from early times. According to some, it is the center of a gigantic prehistoric earthwork, and the surrounding streams, field boundaries, roads and other topographical features, if traced out, reveal a great primeval zodiac. The 16th century magician Dr. John Dee, a confidant of Queen Elizabeth I, is recorded as having investigated Glastonbury on these grounds. Dion Fortune was one of the first to take the idea of ley lines and power centers seriously. This is not surprising if she situated herself at the center of one. In fact, much of what might be called the threefold strand of tradition to be found in the work of Dionne Fortune is to be found in Glastonbury itself. The books she wrote on the subject have guided many along this threefold way. One of her earliest was called Sane Occultism, and this was the keynote to her whole outlook and approach. Her common sense method of systematic training in the development of higher consciousness used Western rather than Oriental traditions. These are represented by the esoteric orders and their work and the training and work of an initiate. And for serious students of symbolism, she wrote the first readily understandable book on the subject, The Mystical Kabbalah, in which she explains in simple terms the Tree of Life, which is the ground plan upon which much of Western traditions are based, or what Dionne Fortune called the Yoga of the West. She was also a novelist of some skill, and used fiction to teach the practice of her theoretical principles. Although, understandably, they have not hit the top bestseller lists, being for a discerning rather than a general public, they have continued in print in edition after edition for nearly half a century. Her last three are considered to be her best, The Winged Bull, The Sea Priestess and Moon Magic. And still more of her work is now coming to light. Of particular interest are her weekly letters to students produced from 1939 to 1942 in the early years of the Second World War. These reveal much of what had hitherto remained secret of some of the techniques of mind working that she had developed over the years. In the crisis of confrontation with the evils of Hitler's Germany when England stood for a time alone against the Axis powers, she helped to maintain the strength and resilience of the group mind of the nation by the evocation of relevant symbolism. Such work is never entirely subjective. Our thoughts and feelings can be as powerful for good or evil as our physical actions, if the right techniques are used. This is why some of the practical applications of occultism have always been closely guarded and revealed only to tried and trusted students. Dionne Fortune regarded herself as very much a woman of the future. She held much the same high vision of her fraternity. This she spells out in one of her monthly letters of 1943 in an article called The Work That Lies Ahead. This was a view evidently shared by the readers of her letters, as the copy I have before me has been underlined by its recipient in the part italicized below. Our position as a fraternity is a unique one. We are of the world, but not in it. We cannot be otherwise than a part of our race and age as long as we are inhabiting time and space. Yet, mentally, those who accept the viewpoint of the fraternity, and have been trained in its discipline until that viewpoint guides their lives, are no part of the age in which they live, but of an age that is yet to come. Well, we are now some 50 years on from when this was written, and it is perhaps possible to take a longer view of these claims and aspirations. One good way is to study these weekly, and later monthly, letters. They are virtually the casebook of a working occultist at a time of national and indeed world crisis, when the barriers of confidentiality were down in the urgency of the hour. One thing that clearly comes across is her faith in her task and her destiny and the cause she served in her characteristic common sense and practical way. The esoteric principles which she had learned, and which she taught, stood her in good stead in this time of testing. Life may be difficult, she writes, but it is not bewildering. Meanwhile, we have to endure. And it is this firm vision and practical leadership that inspired those who gathered round her. Practicalities had to come first: coping with the dispersal of the members of the fraternity, precautions for the air raids, and the aftermath of the bombing. The war has to be fought and won on the physical plane, she says, before physical manifestation can be given to the archetypal ideals which with every week that passes are coming more clearly into view. But it is these archetypal ideals that are the province of the working occultist, and the formulation and dissemination of these in the early days of the war were very much part of Dionne Fortune's practical task. As she recalls, those who received this letter when it was a weekly letter, written almost without exception with enemy planes overhead, and sent out in order to hold the fraternity together during the dark days of the Blitz, will remember that it shadowed forth those ideals which today are rapidly assuming form as ideas in every man's mind. Those ideals, in their archetypal form, and their mode of realization, may now be read at leisure in the extracts from her letters that follow. Those were heady and unusual times. Exceptional circumstances calling for exceptional remedies. Those who were with us in those days, she recalls, will remember how we opened our doors and welcomed all who would sit in meditation with us and taught them the esoteric methods of mind working that had never been revealed before outside the veil of the mysteries, and that this work was done with a view to bringing into manifestation those very ideas that are now manifesting. What part we played in their manifestation we cannot know, but we do know that whereas then the fraternity was a voice crying in the wilderness, the cry has now become a chorus. These ideas are those that shaped the pattern of post-war social change and reconstruction, from the foundation of a welfare state to the reconstruction of the League of Nations. Britain was seething with such ideas at the time she writes, when the tide of the war had turned, to allow visions of the future beyond those of mere survival. At a particular level of realization, all such ideas have to be translated from archetypal ideals into practical politics. And it is here that the work of the occultist stops. The archetypes that we worked to bring into manifestation as seed ideas in the group mind of the race have struck root and are beginning to show above the soil, she continues. Our task in this matter is therefore finished, for it is no part of our work, in fact it is expressly forbidden to us, to come down into the arena of politics. Our work in this direction is therefore done. What was sown will grow and bear seed. It is out of our hands now. The ideals have been worked out as ideas, and the ideas will be hammered into shape as policies, and the policies will be driven through in the face of the inertia and self-interest always opposed to the growth of life, on whatever plane. Practical realization always results in some measure of shabby or expedient compromise. Much the same was found after the previous Great Fire of London, of 1666, when the vision of Sir Christopher Wren, whom Dion Fortune cites more than once, was frustrated in the building of a new city. And after the Second World War, even what vision Wren had achieved in the skyline of London was further blighted by similar forces, combined opportunism and vested interest throwing up their glass and concrete towers of corporate hubris. Sustained with the optimism of faith in God and the driving force of spiritual evolution, Dion Fortune was prepared to take the longer view in her expectations of the manifestation of the vision splendid, which will come to pass with the passage of time, perhaps sooner, perhaps later, but with absolute certainty, because he will turn and overturn till he whose right it is shall reign. This attitude of faith bears witness to her personally long-proven experience of working with those she called the masters. These contacts, which she had developed as early as 1922, and probably before, evince a deeper level of realization and wisdom than is the general run of what is latterly called channeling. Some examples will be found in the letters that follow, and their tone is characterized by the response to an understandably anxious question as to when the war was likely to end. The reply was, "I cannot tell you when it will end, but I can tell you how it will end. When the conditions that gave rise to it have been worked out, it will end." Of the direct question as to a definite date in time, this response comes from outside of our normal perception of events and of time. The events in the outer world are seen firmly as the expression of the consciousness and state of soul of contemporary man, and this applies to individuals as well as to groups. An elementary but often difficult realization for the general occult student. Dion Fortune goes on to say, ostensibly in her own words, although the tone bears the hallmarks of direct quotation from her source of inner wisdom, the causes that gave rise to the war lie deeper than the will to power of one man, or even of a nation, they lie in the souls of the mass of mankind in the attitude towards life and standards of conduct of the innumerable individuals that make up the mass of the democratic as well as the totalitarian countries, for there is no such thing as a mass apart from the units that compose it. Lessons have to be learned, lessons in the art of living and the process of evolution, and individuals have to change until the mass is leavened. This throws an interesting light on the radical changes that are and have been taking place in the modern world, and which seem to have gathered pace as human realizations have responded to the ease of modern communication. When wars and the results of wars are shown within the hour on home television screens worldwide, not filtered through the cold print of journalistic dispatches, days or weeks after the event, it may also demonstrate the importance of the less noticeable esoteric work of those who have their mental antennae attuned to the inner world of ideals and ideas. Their long-term result lies in the climate of public opinion, of which even the most despotic of rulers are keen to take account. And what of the future of her group? Diane Fortune asks, and describes it as a small, carefully selected and highly trained group of people, dedicated to the service of the race and the study of the wisdom that enables them the better to serve God and man. She summarizes its achievement. Through the course of long years of laborious work, with little enough to show for it in the eyes of men, a channel of communication between the physical plane and the inner planes has been opened, which enables those who use it to come and go in a way little realized by anyone who has not had experience of the higher grades of the mystery tradition. What use is to be made of this instrument? She wonders, but gives no immediate or specific answer. For the path of the mysteries, whether that of an individual or that of a group, is ever the choice and the taking of the very next step. As in mountaineering, however high the intention and the vision, the way to get there is a matter of one firm hand or foothold at a time. However, in the 50 years that have since elapsed, apart from whatever may have been achieved in seeding human consciousness as a whole with spiritual ideals, her fraternity, or society as it was later to be known to the outer world, has played an important function in the teaching of the teachers of another generation. Many of the familiar names on esoteric bookshelves have served some form of apprenticeship in the Society of the Inner Light, or otherwise come under its influence, at first or second hand. To say nothing of the important work of those who never bothered to get into print. Much of this has been achieved by the process of seeding. The inner light has spread from source, itself a ray from a golden dawn, to torch of learning, candle of vision, and sanctuary lamp on individual shrines in many diverse ways. And gone are the days when any splitting off from a parent group is seen only in terms of failure, betrayal or schism. More is it a question of the spreading of dandelion clocks of wisdom and experience, floating abroad on the four winds, to grow anew. Whether one wishes to put the popular epithet Aquarian to it, the modern way is much more open. This is not merely an aftermath of the 60s revolution, but the wider, deeper, process of what has been called the externalization of the hierarchy. Not that the days of the enclosed formal group are a thing of the past. But certainly the choice for the seeker is a much more open and broader one than ever in the past. Now, with the publication of these letters, at least in part, the task of those who run the plethora of informal, less structured groups, on a more or less informal basis, or ad hoc workshops, sometimes to a surprising degree of power, can read how one of the old school, when confronted with abnormal circumstances, coped with running an extended and informally structured meditation group, capable of becoming a formidable force in the group soul of the nation. Also, in its week-by-week record, in the earlier stages of the war, we have before us the chapter in the autobiography of a working occultist. And to some extent this may give the light to the assumptions held in some quarters that by this time Dionne Fortune had in any way fallen away from her lifelong views and contacts. She is shown in these letters as a very capable, common sense, and courageous leader, over a broad front of mystical, mythological and hermetic channels of evocation, at a particularly difficult time. The weekly open meditation work was eventually discontinued, not because it was unsatisfactory, but because it had developed to such an extent that it had become unwieldy. Not only had the numbers participating increased beyond all expectation, but the work had developed a degree of power that made it no longer possible to maintain an ever-open door. This is a problem, of success, that will be familiar to a number of modern teachers and facilitators. The very nature of the mysteries, beyond a mere philosophical interest, imposes a certain graded structure, for some are capable of contacting and sustaining more powerful inner dynamics than others. This is largely a matter of training and experience. As Dionne Fortune succinctly puts it, outsiders who came in at the beginning grew with the work, but once the work had developed in the way it did, it was no longer possible to take in outsiders. Dion Fortune's solution to this problem was to close the doors to all but those who were prepared to undergo formal preliminary training. Nowadays, much of that preliminary training has come into the public domain. And this largely through the efforts and offices of those who passed at one time or another through the portal of the mysteries under the guidance of Dion Fortune. In the letters that follow, a revealing chink is made in the veil that guards that portal, enabling us to see at first hand something of the work that went on within, in those days of a previous generation of adepts and initiates of the Western esoteric tradition. It will be seen that the ideals and the practicalities remain the same. The letters, the weekly letters of Dion Fortune, constitute an important part of her life's work, and are historically important in that they demonstrate a method of magical working, using national and racial archetypes. But for the conditions of war, they would have been reserved to the inner circle of senior initiates in her occult group, but with members dispersed and meetings difficult because of air raids and traveling restrictions, the circulation of weekly letters to a wider circle of associates was deemed to be a way of keeping the work of the group going. Hitherto, Dion Fortune's writings, and this includes such important works as The Mystical Kabbalah, had appeared in the Society of the Inner Lights magazine, which had been running since 1927. This ceased publication in August 1940, but the weekly letters continued. The rationing of paper did not allow both publications to survive, and the letters were obviously held to be more important. They continued until the end of 1942 when, the severity of the immediate national crisis being over, they were replaced by a monthly letter. The practical importance attached to the weekly letters is best illustrated by the preliminary document which was sent out at the beginning of October 1939, just 1 month after the outbreak of war. It was headed Meditation Instructions and gave details of how the subsequent letters were to be treated. It is worth reproducing in full, for it contains excellent instruction on meditation techniques. Meditation Instructions. The members of the Fraternity of the Inner Light have been carefully trained in the theory and practice of meditation. Every Sunday morning from 12.15 to 12.30, certain members will hold a meditation circle in the sanctuary at 3 Queensbury Terrace. Other members, scattered all over the country, will also sit in meditation at the same time. Thus a nucleus of trained minds will be formed. All who care to join in this work are invited to participate. They should proceed as follows. The weekly letters will be sent every Wednesday in order to ensure the punctual arrival in time for the following Sunday. On that day, but not one before, study the contents of the letter in preparation for the United Meditation at 12:15. It is inadvisable to study the papers sooner than this, lest the concentration on the previous week's work be disturbed. Success can only be achieved by single-pointed concentration. The meditation work consists of certain well-defined stages, each of which must be carefully performed before passing on to the next. These stages are the steps of a stair on which the mind rises to a higher level of consciousness, performs certain work there, and then returns to normal. For convenience sake, they are numbered in sequence. Stage 1. Having studied the letter, take your seat if possible in a quiet, dimly lit room, secure from disturbance, face towards London, sit in such an attitude that your feet are together and your hands clasped, thus making a closed circuit of yourself. Your hands should rest on the weekly letter lying on your lap, for these letters will be consecrated before they are sent out in order that they may form a link. Breathe as slowly as you can without strain, making a slight pause at the beginning and ending of each breath. Thus, breathe in, pause, breathe out, pause. The attitude should be poised and free from all strain, either sitting or lying. If sitting, have some support for the back. The position should be symmetrical so that both sides of the body are the same. LT should be taken up a few minutes before the meditation is due to start, so that you have time to settle down into a posture of balanced relaxation and stabilize your breathing. Once the meditation has begun, think no more about your breathing. Stage 2. Commence your meditation by thinking about the subject allotted for the work of the week. Try and realize its spiritual implications, but do not attempt to consider its practical ones, for this will distract you and cause mind wandering.